you are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
You are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
Hello, and welcome to another exciting episode of Treasury Cast, the show that celebrates the greatest comics format of all time, the Treasury Edition. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and joining me this week to talk about DC Special Series number 25, the Superman 2 Collector's Album, is the biggest Superman fan I know, my pal, Michael Bailey. Hi, Michael.
Hey, this title is a mouthful, sir.
It is. The DC Special Series is one of those weird books where, like, whatever DC did, like, whatever they needed, they used DC Special Series. You know, like, it was like a treasury. It was a digest. It was a regular size. It was like an 80-pager. I don't know what weird tax regulation they had, but it was just like, just put that on anything, whatever we need. We have a one-shot. Just call it DC Special Series.
But no, I'm very happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, I said, I can't imagine. Yes?
Excuse me, sir. I think you're sitting in my favorite seat.
Your seat's in there, Four Eyes.
Mike, we're both wearing glasses.
I didn't like your meat anyways.
Well, okay. Apparently Chris Franklin is here, too. Hi, Chris.
I thought this was a Superman Movie Minute episode, so I showed up. I'm like, it's, what?
It's both of these things, because, of course, we are here. Chris and I are here. To talk about something very, we're here to talk about the Superman 2 collector's album, but we also, for another reason, is that we have something to announce. Chris, do you want to announce what that is?
Is that Superman 2 Movie Minute?
That it is Superman 2 Movie Minute. It is debuting what day?
On May the 6th.
That is right. If you're listening to this on the day the episode drops, and you should, it's in the bylaws. This is Monday, May 4th. So this is Saturday, May 4th. So 2 days from now will be the beginning of Superman 2 Movie Minute. We will finally be starting our look at that movie, and eventually joining us down the line will, of course, be Michael Bailey. So that's why I'm having them both here to talk about this Treasury Edition. So welcome to both of you.
We're waiting to the end of the episode to announce that when you get to Superman 4 Movie Minute, I will be taking over the show completely.
You will be taking over the show. I'm handing the keys over to you, handing you all the passwords, all the dirty stuff about Shag that you don't know, although I don't know what that is left at this point. But
I've known him quite a bit, so yeah.
So he's got Dragon Con dirt on him, so yeah. You know.
Oh my god, I don't even want to think about that. Okay, so like I said, we're here to talk about DC Special Series number 25, which was the Superman 2 Collector's Album, and much like what happened with the first Superman Collector's Album Treasury Edition, which Chris and I covered a couple of years ago, Mike, why do you explain why there is no Superman 2 straight-up adaptation? Why is this a collector's album and not a comic book?
Because they wanted to cheat Mario Puzo out of money. There was a thing that Mario Puzo would get a piece of anything associated with the scripts that he wrote. And I think Superman 2 is stretching it a bit, because I don't know if they used any of his ideas for Superman 2.
Right.
But if they would have done a comic book adaptation or a novelization, they would have had to pay him money. And I guess they were just tired of paying everybody money for this movie, for these movies. I mean, once you've done like 2-3 million for Marlon Brando, you're kind of tapped out at that point. Mm-hmm. So they do this collector's album, which kind of sort of serves as an adaptation in a weird way, because it's really kind of different from the first one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. And it's so tragic in that of all the comic book movies ever made, this is the story. This is the movie that would have worked best as a comic mm-hmm. book.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. But I mean, like Mike said, this works as like a photo novel in a lot of ways, more so than the first Superman Treasury Edition. So
that's true. That's true. And it's a double shame when you think about that so little of Puzo's material ended up in really either one of these movies. It's really Tom Mankiewicz that would have had the claim to say, hey, I should get money if you're going to adapt my story, my screenplay into a comic book. And so it's, but Puzo had a lot of heft, you know, he's coming off The Godfather and he had the ability to pull it. So that is why, even to this day, there is no adaptation of Superman 1 or 2 in comic book form, which is unreal.
And here's the thing is that you really, it's too late to do it, because the great thing about comic book adaptations and novelizations from this era, from the era Superman 2 came out, is that they had things that were in the original script that weren't, that didn't make it to the movie or were left on the cutting room floor. So you kind of had your director's cut that way. And now with the movie being out for, you know, as many, you know, like almost, God, we're coming up on 38 years, I think it is.
Yep.
This year, that, you know, everybody's seen it. So the thing I will liken it to, and I know you hate Transformers, Rob, but they did Marvel did an adaptation of Transformers, the movie, back in 1986, and it was terrible.
Yes.
But IDW, when they got the license, did a new adaptation of Transformers, the movie, with really slick art, but it was just like watching stills from the movie because they just followed the movie. They didn't adapt a script. They adapted a film. So at this point, you couldn't really do an adaptation because all you would be seeing is artists and writers redrawing frames from the film.
That's true. I didn't really thought about that, but you're right. Because with that, if you just have a screenplay, you're interpreting it in your own way. But then if you have the movie, you can't possibly get it out of your head. I mean, if somebody said to an artist, draw the scene where Superman flies up to the window, you're only going to draw that one way.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
Panel one, the back. Panel two, him sitting there with his arms folded. I mean,
just... yeah, exactly. I mean, what else is there to do? So I assume that both of you had this when it came out, Chris. You assume you got it at the time?
Yeah, I picked this up right off the stands. I think I picked this one up and then went back for the Superman and his Fortress of Solitude Treasury that came out at the same time. So that was a big summer for Treasuries and me, the last gasp of DC Treasuries in a lot of ways, because I missed the Batman versus the Hulk Treasury, which is sad. But yeah, so I picked this up right from Eastside Pharmacy, my usual comic book haunt. That's where I got my mom to pluck down the $2.95 for this one. Yeah,
it was kind of pricey actually for a Treasury. They weren't typically $3 at this point. I wonder why. I guess maybe they had to pay a little more just because they were using a lot of likeness. You know, they were using photos of people, like a little more of a licensing thing. But I just realized that $3, they typically weren't $3. Mike, I assume you had this one as well?
No. I was not really buying – unlike Chris, I didn't come out of the womb you know, like with a comic book in my hand. But, and I say that with love. No, I found this and the one for Superman the movie at a comic shop in Athens, Georgia, when I was visiting a friend. He had moved down there or up there, wherever Athens is. And I went and visited him for a weekend with another buddy of mine. And Athens being a college town, they had a comic shop. And it wasn't your bright, shiny, new, you know, like, you know, strip mall comic shop. This place had been around for a long time. And just buried under a bunch of stuff were Superman the movie and Superman 2 movie treasuries. And I'm like, well, how much are these? He goes, I'll give them for $5 a piece. And I'm like, you are sold. So I always feel bad coming on to, like, you know, with people who like bought it off the rack essentially, but just because of how I came into comics and started so late in life, I always seem to be playing catch up. But it's still in great condition 20 years later.
This is a safe space, Mike. You come to appreciate the treasuries is fun.
But no, I was. These were the first two Superman treasuries I ever bought. I started picking them up a little more regularly after that.
All right, very cool. So yeah, I mean the album, the cover, I'm sorry, is just kind of a mix of a bunch of stills. You got Superman flying. You got Lois in the clutches two different times in the clutches of the villains, and then you got Superman putting a half Nelson on General Zod, and then a nice big close-up of Christopher Reeve. And it's, the immortal legend lives on in this spectacular collector's album. Stars, costumes, set designs, special effects, it's all so very exciting. And the first page of this thing, when you open it, the inside cover, I feel like I am already on this book's side. because it is a checkerboard of six rows of panels, four panels each, six rows, four panels each, intercutting a comic book panel with a still from the movie. And I love this because one of the things that, you know, this is something that people of a certain age kind of grew up on is like comic book superhero stuff, when it was adapted, frequently tried to like hide its comic book origins. You know, they were always like kind of almost like ashamed of it. But here I like that DC is literally going, here's the source. Here's what they're doing. Here's the source. Here's what they're doing. I love that. I love that they are equating the two things. You know, they're equal. It's like, hey, the comic books, here's the movie. I love this inside cover. I just think it's such a nice touch.
Yeah, this has always been one of my favorite aspects of this book. I remember just staring at these pages, the inside front and back cover with these images on it, and just really like thinking about how well they matched up, you know, and some of them match up really close and others not as much. But the general feel of both of them is the same, and it really does show how close. I mean, the movies do take some liberties with Superman lore, but it does show how, you know, well it does match up. And sometimes the aspects that maybe we forgot about Superman that weren't in the current comics, but they match back up to the older comics. And this was like my introduction to some of the earlier Superman art, you mm-hmm. know, that I hadn't seen in, because the Digest didn't tend to go back beyond the Silver Age much when they reprinted. And that was my gateway to older DC comics was the Digests, because I'd missed 100-page Giants and most of the Treasury reprints when I was younger. So this is my first glance at some of the early Schuster Studio guys that did some really, really nice work. I've always loved that shot of Superman going Goddard when he's grabbing Lois, like, I think she's like drowning or something, and he catches her, and I think that looks like Jack Burnley or somebody. Mm-hmm. It looks like, and it's really nice. Yeah.
In a time before computers, when you could just kind of Google, like, you know, you could go to a database and look the stuff up, you probably had to have some poor DC staffer going through all these old Superman comics trying to find the right panel. I mean, they found one where it's like, you see Lois saying, "I smell something rotten, Clark, and I intend to find out what it is. Don't do anything reckless, Lois." And then they pair that up with the shot of just before Lois chucks herself into Niagara Falls. It's like, what a great find that is. It's exactly what you're talking about. So, you know, well done, unnamed DC staffer.
Oh, come on. Enel said Bridwell is listed as a contributor. They probably just showed him that with his computer-like mind. He just spit out issue numbers and page numbers. So
that would clearly be Superman number 76, page 11. All right, thanks. Thanks, Delson.
The 12th level intellect of the DC offices.
So the opening page, and it says DC Comics presents Superman 2, the movie magazine, Jeanette Kahn publisher, designed and written by Joe Orlando and Michael Fleischer. That's funny. At no point does anybody get cut in half by scissors. And it has contributors, and it lists the artists. And then design consultant Judy Garland, not Garland, Garland. I don't know who Judy Garland is, but I think she did a nice job. I think overall this is a very well-designed treasury. Like, it's really sharp-looking. So good job, Ms. Garland.
Yeah. It you said before – I'm sorry to interrupt you, Chris.
You're fine.
That you know, in this day and age, this would all be done on a desktop. You know, they would just have all the images there, and they would position them. You know, this was all probably cut and pasted.
Yep.
And then photographed. I mean, that's – can't even think of doing that.
Yeah, the amount of legwork it took to do all this is just pretty stunning, you know? I mean, it's just like a lot of work. But maybe that's why it cost $2.95. They were like, hey, everybody put more work into this. We're going to charge a little more. So, and the first opening salvo is The Legend Lives On, and it talks about the history of Superman, and it moves right on to The Adventure Continues. And in the Adventure Continues page, this is the first inkling we get of seeing some production art. And there is a really nice little watercolor painting of Superman flying Lois above the skies of Metropolis, paired up with the image from the first movie. And it's a really – it's very rough. Like, you can see the figures are not really very well defined. But it's I actually really like it. It works as just like a little painting.
Mm-hmm. No. I remember when I was a kid thinking, though, wow, that's really rough. I remember, you know, I didn't get it that they just did these type of things for just the basic mood and ambiance shot, basically, you know, that it was expressionistic, you know, more than anything. I didn't get that, so I thought, wow, that was like really unfinished, you know, to me as a kid.
It reminds me a lot of storyboards. When you see storyboards mm-hmm. by some artists are bare bones figures, and it really is just more about the setup and stuff like that. But that always looked like a sweet gig to me, because I'm like, wow, you don't even really have to finish the drawing. You can just sort of indicate some things. You're like, all right, can I get my check, please? So I really like that painting. I think it's again, it's impressionistic. But I think it's really sweet. And you can see that they took that. I mean, it's a perfect way to express, you know, to show, okay, this is what the shot's going to look like. And, you know, be damned if they didn't get it exactly right in the movie.
Right.
I like that Lois looks kind of like a ghost. That's just, to me, this could be used in a variety of different ways.
Yeah, it's cool. I dig it. So the next thing is they talk about some scenes from Superman 2, and there's some photos, and we got a shot of Margot Kidder. We have that shot of Clark Kent as he hits the taxi cab in a scene that makes no bloody sense, but, you know, whatever. And then Clark giving water to Lois with her best friend. And then they just talk about it. It just basically sets up like, okay, this is where we are in the story. We're going to be moving forward. And then it moves on to page 5 is the Phantom Zone. The introduction of the Phantom Zone. And I love that shot of the three villains as the camera zooms down on them and they're just in that circle. I think mm-hmm. It's just so iconic. Like, it's so simple, and yet it just, I don't know. I love looking at that.
It looks like it could be on a Marvel comic cover in the corner back in the 70s or something, or the DC when they had the bubbles on the DC cover. I mean, it's like, you know, it's Phantom Zone, the Phantom Zone comic. There's the little icon in the corner, so it stands out on the newsstand, you know.
So I'm gonna make two comments about the last two pages. One, the text on the previous page says that the taxi cab isn't too badly damaged. I don't know how you can look at that vehicle and not think that they're going to just junk it. And two, ignoble. General Zod remains cold and impassive as he and his ignoble cohort. It's like, wow, you're teaching kids new words. Good job, DC Comics.
Yeah. The hell does ignoble mean? Yeah, exactly. That's one of the things I love about comic books is they do that for kids, you know, because you care about it. I wouldn't get – if I had heard the word ignoble in a book at school, I would be like, what do I care? I'll just live without not knowing what it is. But the Phantom Zone villains are ignoble? I got to find out. It's important to me.
Yeah, I mean, it's how many times did kids of, you know, our generation run to the dictionary, you know, to look those words up? I know I've heard Stan Lee talk about that, you know, hey, if kids did that, then, hey, you know, that he was doing that was an extra bonus of mm-hmm. being, you know, extra alliterative in his comics and everything. So
So the next page that we see there is a sample from one of the comic books where we see Superman and Supergirl talking about the Phantom Zone, and there's some insets of our three villains. And again, I really love this, that they are making this effort to go back and show you, hey, this is from the comics. This is, you know, this is not the movie. This is they're adapting what we've already done. Then there's a shot in the next page of the astronaut as he's been propelled into space by Zod kicking him. And then there's another shot of them down in Houston. And then we see the Superman strip, and it says, as demonstrated by this comic book sequence from the early 1960s, any Kryptonian convict released from the Phantom Zone automatically acquires superpowers like Superman in the alien environment of Earth. And, you know, it's like, I love this back and forth between the comics and the movies. I think this is just really, really – I'm probably going to keep saying that a lot through this issue, but I just find it so charming.
Yeah, it's really nice.
You know, it's funny that, you know, I think even you and Shag discussed a little bit on the Who's Who podcast when you discussed the Phantom Zone entry that, you know, it was created by Jor-El. And I think people in the modern era are like, wow, that's just such a terrible thing to do to these people. How could you take them and put them in phantom forms? And then you read some of the crimes. It's like, they banished me here because I destroyed a moon near Krypton. I'm here because I tossed a formula into the Great Lake of Krypton, which caused ordinary fish into monsters. And I created a freeze ray, which could freeze humans solid. Like, of course you're going to put these people away. They're monsters.
Yeah, that's right. And then you stick Mon-El in there with them for 1,000 years.
I know. Oh, we don't even get into that. Oh, poor Mon-El. Poor Mon-El.
I'm just allergic to lead. I don't deserve this.
It's like a kid that has a peanut allergy and you stick him in Attica. I mean, it just doesn't.
You're too much trouble to deal with. All right, we'll work on this in the next 1,000 years. By the way, I'm going to go dress up as Batman so I can fool Lois Lane. I have time for that. But I don't have time to work on. All right, whatever. Super Dickory strikes again. Following that is the first ad in this book, which is for Atari Games, and it's promoting three games: Asteroids, Missile Command, and Superman the Game. Did either one of you have that game?
I did not have Superman the Game. I wish I did. I remember seeing it in this ad and wanting it. I had the other two, but not Superman. Go figure.
You didn't want this game. I didn't have it for my Atari. A friend did, and you basically just ran around. You got into a phone booth, you change into Superman, fly around, do a couple things, then you get back into the phone booth and change into Clark Kent. Now, I do have a cartridge that a friend sent me because he found it at a yard sale. And he thought I would like it. So I have the cartridge, but the cartridge, I mean, it was an Atari cartridge. So there was no art on the cover or anything. It just says Superman. But box art is selling a game that is writing a check that the game can't cash.
Yeah, I had this game and it really was pretty uninspiring for the most part. But yeah, the box art is out of this world. No pun intended. It's got a Neil Adams shot and a Kurt Swan shot. I mean, you can't. Yeah, it's fantastic. So
yeah, I love that. I've got a t-shirt that said that's Superman number 300, the Kurt Swan.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's right. Boxer.
Yeah, that's where that's from. Yeah, I love right. that. I love that the image, that cover. And this makes me think it's not that, but when I see this, I think of that awesome Superman arcade game that was out in the 80s. And, oh, God, I love that game. And when you had two players, the other one kind of looked like Superman Red. So it's like Superman Blue and Superman Red. I love that game.
I was at a convention last year. They started a new comic convention here in Atlanta, and they had an arcade section. And that was there. And you could just play it. You didn't have to pay any money.
Oh, wow.
So I just, like, I'm walking along with a friend. I felt so bad for her. I'm walking along with a friend, and I go, wait. And I just walk away because I see the game. My wife is used to this. My other friends are not yet. So,
next up, we have a house ad for DC. It's where we don't rest on our laurels thing, which is one of their fun house ads with all the covers spiraling out for you. And then it says, and coming this fall, Batman versus the Hulk, a spectacular event. Don't miss it. So you look at these books. There are some really great comics.
Uh-huh.
All-Star Squadron number 1, Justice League of America 194, Iraq number 1, which I know people make fun of Iraq, but I like it. World's Finest number 271. I mean, you look at these and you're like, this is – I want all of these. These are all – they look great.
I love these ads because it shows you that there was a time when DC did every kind of genre imaginable. Mm-hmm. You know, most of these are superheroes, but you've got Westerns, you've got like a horror title, you've got Sword and Sandal, you've got War. I mean, it's just like every time I see an ad like this, it's like I want to read every single one of these comics. I know like some of them are going to be terrible, but I was just like, this ad does its job.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, and this ad tells you that Roy Thomas is at DC because you got All-Star Squadron number 1 and World's Finest 271, where he makes all the different Superman Batman origins work, in quotes, but they're all there, you know, and I love that. That's one of my favorite comics of all time. So,
yeah, I love World's Finest 271. So now we have a profile of the three villains. We have a shot of General Zod, and we have a thing on Ursa, which features a shot that I'm unfamiliar – no, okay. I know it's from the movie in that I just think it's an alternate camera shot of where the sheriff, the sheriff's deputy is staring at Ursa's waist. It's a weird shot to stop on. Mm-hmm. I think it's the scene in the movie where he bends over and then he looks up and she's standing there. And it's all kind of a fluid motion. But to freeze frame it, it just looks like he's kind of staring at her crotch, which is a little strange.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of Sarah Douglas's crotch in this treasury, and we'll get to that soon.
There's a lot of Sarah Douglas in this.
A lot of Sarah Douglas. And then we have a thing of Non, where he's holding the missile before he breaks, and then he picks up the sheriff's car. So, again, they're going through the three villains. There's an ad for Warner Home Video, which is like a very strange ad because they're talking about Superman the movie for sale and Nelve Animation 4 Cosmic Fantasies in 1, Bugs Bunny the Roadrunner movie. It's all, it's kind of like all kid stuff. And then A Little Romance with Laurence Olivier, which is not a kid's movie. So I don't know what that was in there for. But, you know, all right, fine. It's okay. And then they move on to the section on Lex Luthor. And there's a couple of really big, juicy shots of Lex, including one that's a full page of him in his prison fatigues that looks – I'm like, that has to be a trading card. It's just too perfect to not be.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's it's a room I can't check.
But yeah, it looks, I mean, it looks like, you know, the portrait that Lex would hang in his, you know,
yes,
in his lair or something, you know, that's the ruler of Australia picture, you know, hanging up in the,
right, yeah, exactly.
In the Capitol.
I put it on all the money at a certain point. Right. Then we move on to the section in Niagara Falls, and there's a great, I love the camera shot of Superman carrying the kid, the dumb kid from the Niagara Falls, and just... The freeze framing of that looks like you could see where Alex Ross gets his stuff from, because mm-hmm. that shot looks like it's out of a dozen different Alex Ross Superman books. That thing of the cape where it's floating, and I mean, obviously they've painted all the strings out. It just looks perfect. Everybody's yelling, "Yay, Superman!" I love that shot.
Yeah,
one of the best saves of the movie too, I would say.
Oh yeah, yeah. Superman defeats Darwinism. Yeah. But yeah, it is, and I'm not going to get a harp on this, guys, but it's so nice to see Superman come in for a gentle landing, you know? Mm-hmm. He's not going to shatter the ground when he lands. He's not going to, you know, property damage out the ass because Superman's either taking off or coming in for a landing, you know? He's just going to float down with this kid, you know? That's what I love.
Yeah. Well, this Superman, the first time he did that, he wrecked like some asphalt behind the farm, and Jonathan just, you know, yelled at him for like an hour about it. So he, after that, he's just like, "Oh, my landings will be soft."
There you go.
So next we move on to the sequence of Clark trying to rescue Lois out of the pool, or in the, not the pool, but like sort of the little alcove there at the Niagara Falls. And then there's this great sequence from some old issue of Lois Lane where Lois is desperate to prove that Clark is Superman, and she fires a machine gun at him.
I love it.
I'm wondering if this is where the screenwriters got the idea for the original version of trying to reveal Clark's identity. But yeah, this is just from an era of the comics where Lois just was not on her A game, and Clark was just a jerk.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, he puts the bullet holes in the glass just to, I mean, they really are blanks, but he tries to convince Lois that they're not blanks.
Right, right.
And it's like she already is convinced that he's not Superman because he ducked out of the way. So he did do the extra dick move of making her think that she almost killed him for no reason.
You know, so. I'm going to teach you a lesson.
Yeah, exactly.
I love Lois with a machine gun. It's like Lois Lane Gun Mall. It's fantastic.
It's drawn by Kurt Schaffenberger.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Yeah. So now we move on to the scene of them and their beginning romance. And there's a full page. It is the beginning of a super love affair. And the photos from the sequence stop just before things get really interesting.
Before we get to Derek William Crab Silver Sheets, is that what you're trying to say, Rob?
That's what I'm trying to say. Yeah. I mean, I guess they could have showed a panel of Wayne Boring drawing a train going into a tunnel or something, but it would be subtle. Why this panel of Superman putting the fortress's key into the lock? I don't understand, but all right, whatever.
There's this scene in Perry White's office, and all fireworks are going on outside, and Perry's like, "Looks like Superman's getting laid."
I was about to make the same joke. I was thinking Johnny Dangerously. Oh, wow. Chris, beat me to it. You really did.
We're having fun, everybody. So, okay. Next up is a newspaper, and it says Supervillains on Rampage. Why there's a newspaper from today in the middle of this old treasury, I don't understand, but that's, you know, who's to say? But it says Daily Planet, Phantom Zone Outlaws Invade Planet, goal is subjugation of planet Earth. Another dictionary word. I didn't know what that meant until I was probably read comic books. Subjugation? That's pretty big.
Yeah. This is a cool shot, although it's like, you know, they take a picture of Perry getting his head slammed up through the ceiling. And,
right.
You know, instill your readers with confidence that your editor is now unconscious or dead.
So then we have a shot of the Phantom Zone villains in Perry's office and the destruction there. They've destroyed everything. And then we bring in back in Lex Luthor, and then there's profiles again of Gene Hackman and Jackie Cooper. And then we get to the super battle for survival. And there's a shot of Superman flying and then insets of them. And there's a big shot of an explosion in the heart of Metropolis. And I, for the life of me, don't remember that shot from the movie. I mean, I've seen this movie 40 billion times, but that particular shot looks, I don't know, looks new to me. I wonder if it's a cut scene.
It's a freeze frame of when he was on the roof using his heat vision to blow snow.
Oh, yeah.
That's what I'm assuming because that makes it look a little more dynamic than the scene actually
is. A little bit. Gives it more of a scope than it really actually has. And on a total sort of graphic design nerd thing, and I know Chris will appreciate this, in this double page spread, the super battle for survival, you've got Superman flying, a shot of Superman flying, and his arm is cutting into a box of text. And they actually moved the text in each line by a couple of spaces to make room for the arm. And man, to do that back in the day where you had to do paste ups, that's a lot of extra work. That was a lot of extra work for some graphic designer. So props to them, because that's, I could see somebody going, all right. And then you have to sit there and literally move all this text over. So well done.
Yeah, nowadays you just, you know, take the picture of Superman, either clip it out or mask it, and then you drop it in a design document, put a text wrap on it, and boom, it's
you're done. Right, exactly, yeah.
But back then, no. That's hours and hours and hours.
Hours of work. That's really, really, I appreciate that extra effort, graphic designer of DC Special Series number 25. And then we have a shot of Superman kicking Zod from the Marlboro truck. It's the closest you're going to get to a cigarette ad in a comic book. and then we see Perry and Lois looking around. There's a black and white shot of Superman just sort of standing there with a kind of interesting framing, is that they cut him out of the frame and made the full figure and then kind of put the movie image behind him like it's almost like a comic book panel. It's kind of a neat blending of a movie and a comic book.
And he looks really mad. I mean, it's just, you know, they have it in the text that fists clenched in anger, eyes ablaze, which would be different today, of course, thanks Jim Lee. You know, this guy looks like this is a Superman that has had enough of your crap, basically.
Yeah, he's got that jaw, that his jaw's jutted out, like, and it's slightly cocked to one side. He's you know, getting real mad at these guys for tearing up his town, what it amounts to.
it's a good shot. And then so there's another two-page spread, and it's just a mix. There's one of Non just before he uses his heat vision, but he looks like he's about to sneeze. There's Superman standing on the bus with all the people. Then there's Lois. There's a character behind Lois who I don't remember from the movie. Another reporter for the or employee of the Daily Planet. I don't remember seeing her in the movie. So that must be a cut scene or something, or just an edit probably. Because I think that's the scene where Lois's friend goes, "The big one's just as strong as Superman." And Lois pushes her out of the way, but I feel like there's this third person and we don't know. And then there's the shot of Christopher Reeve picking up Zod in the most humiliating way possible and tossing him around like a frisbee, which is one of the more badass moves of Superman.
Yeah, I love that.
And then we have another double page spread, and it's Superman using the mirror to reflect the heat vision, which I don't know. I don't think science agrees with you on that. I think the glass would just melt. I don't think glass is like nigh indestructible. But you know, what do I know?
But then we get the best super breath moment ever right after that. Well, other than the lake in Superman 3, but you know, I mean, one of the best super breath moments after that. So it's worth it.
That's true. Yeah, I like that. And then we kind of go back a little bit in the movie, and we have the shot of Superman transforming. And this is your favorite transformation, right, Chris? Isn't this scene?
Yes, this is the – and I think Michael agrees with me because mm-hmm. when I put it on Facebook, he agreed. This is the best – this is not from him rushing into the battle, as the caption says. This is from the beginning of the movie with the best shirt
right, in the alleyway, right.
ever. Yeah, the change from when he's going to Paris to save Lois and stop the hydrogen bomb. This is Superman Clark changing into Superman, and this is just it's not really a still because it's an effect shot, but you see multiple images of Superman. I wish they'd done a whole spread of mm-hmm. the change. Oh my God, if they'd done that, I'd like ripped it out and hung it on my wall. You know.
So. Well, that's and that image and that sequence is one of those things that if I choose to get into the dumb arguments that people get into because I've just completely lost my patience and taste for it. But everybody that wants to talk about how the Donner cut is superior, I'm like, you wouldn't get that. You wouldn't get that alley change. That was it's probably one of my favorite parts of the entire movie. One of the best musical cues of the entire film series. So yeah, guys, I'm sorry, you lose.
Yep.
Yeah.
You do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I my love for Richard Donner is rich and deep. You could drizzle it on pancakes, but the Superman 2 Donner cut is not a finished movie. We'll Chris and I will get into that in future episodes of the show. So the next shot we have the shot of Ursa going, let us take his favorite. She's about to grab Lois, and then there's a really nice shot, black and white, of Superman just flying. It looks just looks fantastic. This looks so cool. His fists are cocked in kind of a different way, so I love that. Then there's a double page spread of Superman's last stand, and then we go back to the fortress with the infamous finger lasers, which all Kryptonians have, right, Mike?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. This is look. I'm sure we could actually find a Silver Age story that this happened in. So,
right. Well, I bet you E. Nelson Bridwell like went and found it and said, "Well, it did happen at least this one time," you know.
Right. But that was after the film, and it was the only way he could live with it. So
right, it kept him up at night, you know, just like you know, just like when he had wrote the Super Friend comic and had to make it fit into Earth One continuity, you know. So
how do I work the Super Friends into this? I know, I figure it out. So, and then we have Non Ursa threatening to tear apart Lois Lane. And then I love this this full page shot of Superman again putting Zod in the half Nelson. And it's this collage background, and it's just sort of funny. There's this single cutout of Zod screaming.
Yeah.
There's no context for it, so he's just yelling. I don't know what it's for, but it just looks – it's like every shot of Zod is him yelling. He just looks like a wrestler or something. He's just constantly screaming for all the time.
Well, this is the
background
cover to
Zod's looks like – oh, go ahead. Go ahead, Mike. Sorry.
This is the cover to Zod's spoken word album.
Oh, my God. Quit reading – we got to quit reading each other's minds. I was going to say this is their prog rock album in the background. Oh, God.
Can you read my mind? Do you know what these things are that you do to me? And now we're getting into a behind the scenes, and we see some actual storyboards, and we see a shot of Superman and Lois on the elevator, and then the thing of the two villains threatening to tear apart Lois Lane. So, and then there's some behind the scenes stuff, and we see who is it? Spengler? Is it? Yeah, Pierre Spengler.
Yeah, Star-Spangled Spengler.
Star-Spangled Spengler. And it's literally them behind the scenes, and we see shots of them looking at some storyboard. So I love all this stuff. This is, like, almost in a lot of ways, this is the thing I would pay my money for, because this is the kind – where else are you going to see this kind of stuff?
I guarantee that shot of Puzo, Spengler, and Margot Kidder was during the production of the first movie.
Mm-hmm,
because they were all way too happy. And Kidder was far from happy with the Salkinds or Spengler by the time they started filming under Lester for Superman 2. So
I feel like the text has to say not pictured Richard Donner. Like, it's like, right. Like, okay, yeah, we've purposely cropped him out of this stuff. So I like all the stuff. Now there's an ad for the Movieland Wax Museum where you can go see this very frightening statue of Christopher Reeve.
I wanted to go see this thing, guys. I think it looks cool. I desperately, like, I think I remember asking my parents, hey, can we go to one of these places? Because I want to go just to see this. I don't, you know. So, I mean, Yeah, I kind of like wax museums when they're done well. And this one, I've been to Metropolis, Illinois, and what they pass off as a Christopher Reeve wax figure is, yeah, that is frightening. And I love the place otherwise, but their Christopher Reeve, they need to get this one. Because,
okay, all right.
Yeah. If you've never seen it, Rob, I have a picture, and it's stunningly scary.
It's okay. Robert Culp as Superman versus Christopher Reeve. It looks more like young Robert Culp, which is really strange.
But I'm here for truth, justice, and the American way.
Yeah, there you go. It's Bill Maxwell as Superman.
I always assume that this dummy that we see in this ad is the dummy that Superman has in the Fortress of Solitude next to all the secret identities that vibrates into hyperspace when somebody comes in. Like, this is what he's got. So they're all just kind of like they're close, but not exactly a cigar. And then next up is And then another ad is for the character phone, the Superman phone, which, oh my God, did I want this so bad? I never got it, but oh. And then there's a Wonder Woman one too, for him and for her. I would have this now. I would get a landline just to have this phone again if I could.
Yeah. Did you catch who's on the phone with the Superman?
That's Saul Harrison, right?
Yes.
President of DC Comics.
Saul Harrison.
And yeah, I assume that's Jeanette Kahn talking on the Wonder Woman phone.
I don't think that's Jeanette Kahn. I think that's the lady that she was in the subscription ads.
Carol Fine.
Yeah.
Carol Fine.
Yeah, that's with Batman and Superman. Yeah, I think that's her. Her and Jeanette Kahn had a similar look, but I don't think that's Jeanette Kahn's profile there.
Yeah, that hair is not coiffed enough for Jeanette Kahn.
Okay, all right. You're right. No, Chris is right. It's Carol Fine. You could see that these things cost $129 for a rotary. Kids, that was a dial that you had to spin around, and it would wind back. You had to take all this time. You didn't just hit a button to make a phone call. And then the touchstones were $149. And so you could see why hardly any kid, even someone who lived a richy rich lifestyle like myself, did not have this phone. Because, I mean, $150 in 1982 money, that's a lot of money.
I do have one question, though. At what point did DeForest Kelly play Superman?
I just love the incredible sexism of the for him, for her, because, you yeah. know, a guy obviously wouldn't want a Wonder Woman phone. You know, it's funny because I think that's $129 or $149 in 1981 dollars.
Yeah.
That's so that's like what, about $1,500 today? Probably.
You could buy it. You could have bought a car back then. This is expensive. Yeah, and it's funny because it said you can write – it's clearly a company that they've outsourced this, and it says write Character Phones Incorporated. So now that makes me think they must have made other character phones, right, if you have a whole company just to do this. So now it makes me think, what other character phones were there? Were there like Spider-Man or like Darth Vader? Like what other character was so famous that it could be a character phone? I've never seen any other phone other than these two, and I've only seen the Wonder Woman one from this ad. So, but there must have been Archie, you know, like what other characters were famous enough to get their own phone?
I know there were Mickey Mouse phones back then,
of course, yeah.
Yeah, beyond that, I remember seeing an ad for these somewhere else. Might have been something Brian Hyler put on Plaid Stallions where they had a Bugs Bunny phone, which would have made sense for Warner Brothers.
Yeah. Right.
You know, but other than that, I don't know. I don't think they made a Batman phone back then.
No.
But now, of course, they'd make a Batman
phone. Now they have like 15 Batman phones.
Yeah. Right. Which Batman do you want? Do you want the Batman TV show phone? Do you want Christian Bale Batman phone? Do you want, you know, yeah, you got a thousand choices for Batman phone. Yeah, right. Well, nobody wants that. I never had that phone. I wished I had. Then there we have another shot, some production art of Superman in the Fortress of Solitude when he's in the chamber and then the lights are going off. And then we have some actor profiles, and we have Christopher Reeve looking quite handsome as he's talking about his career, and he's talking about his work on Broadway and stuff like that, and how much he's excited about being in part of Superman 2. And then there's a nice shot of him flying, which again looks like a trading card shot. And then we have another ad where for your complete library of Superman bestsellers. And there was Superman Miracle Monday, the Superman Cutout, Superman Last Son of Krypton, the Quiz Book, the Great Superman Book, Superman Blueprint, Superman Portfolio. I mean, this is like Warren Publications level marketing. You know, we know that you're a Superman fan, so here's all the other Superman stuff you can buy.
I want to just to back. I mean, I think that ad's great. The photo of Superman flying on that page, which is looks like it's from the alley shot as well,
yes,
Mike,
yep.
Like a different angle. I always loved that shot, but Superman's feet have always bothered me in that shot. It looks like his feet look weird from that position or mm-hmm. something. It's like his legs and his feet from that perspective look really odd. I think it's just where his calf and his boots and his soles of his feet are running together because all the red, and it's just it's really strange looking. If you look at Superman's feet, you're like, what? It's just kind of weird.
How does he stand on those things? They're all rubbery. I don't understand what's happening.
Right. I'm surprised my mom didn't rip the Christopher Reeve profile pages out of this thing. Because she was in love with Christopher Reeve, let me tell you. And my dad knew it, too. I think he was the list, you know, basically. So, and my mom, I'm going to tell this. My mom, she's passed on stuff, but she probably said this when I was way too young, but she said, you could put those red boots under my bed anytime. So,
wow. Wow.
Yeah.
So I have Miracle Monday and I have Last Son of Krypton and the quiz book. And the Great Superman book is actually right next to me right now. So I started looking into these other things just to see, they're obviously on eBay. So I found a thing of the blueprints, and it was just like, you know, they were asking like $15. And I'm like, okay, don't have the money now, but watch, and we'll wait and see. Looked up the Superman portfolio. Between $150 and $300 is what people are asking for this. So I'm like, obviously not going to be picking that up anytime soon.
Yikes! Gee, oh my goodness, too many Christmas. Yeah, I had a couple of these things, but it's sort of funny. You see that this is really the beginning of DC, I think, figuring this stuff out. And mm-hmm. You know, I mentioned Warren. Like Warren had that. James Warren had that figured out a long time ago. That it was like, hey, people are buying your magazine full of stories about Dracula and monsters and spacemen. So I'm going to sell you this kind of stuff in the back pages because you're already interested. And this was, right. You know, DC was figuring out, well, if you like enough to spend $2.95 on a Superman movie treasury, you're going to want all this other stuff. So here you go. Here's the order form. You know, like, well, let's cut right to the chase. So it's the beginning of that them learning, like, hey, there's a lot of money to be made in this merchandising. So we moved on to the actor profiles. There's a thing of Terrence Stamp, which features a quote of the pull quote, "If I weren't an actor, I could be dangerous," which I feel like you could just sub podcaster for actor and it would work all the same. And he mentioned some of his other credits, and it talks about the 1962 Billy Budd, which is an adaptation of a Herman Melville book, another Herman Melville book. And I will say this, when I was in grade school, they showed us Billy Budd over like 3 nights or something, or 3 days of school. Cause you know, it was like a 60-minute class and it was a 2-hour movie. The movie is crushingly boring. I mean, it is just deadly dull. But the only reason I was interested is because I knew it was General Zod. I was like, I knew who it was. That kept me interested. Otherwise, I would have completely tuned out.
Right. I mean, and Terrence Stamp makes the Disney Haunted Mansion movie worth watching, you know, because wow. Terrence Stamp's in it. So.
Yeah, there's no other reason to watch that film. I caught the end of it, and I'm like, wow, Eddie Murphy, what is wrong with you?
And that's my favorite Disney ride, but the movie, I mean, not so much.
Okay. It also mentions in the Stamp profile that when he met Federico Fellini, and I've remarked on this in other episodes of Treasure Cast where we've talked about movie adaptations where, you know, these are ostensibly meant for children, these books, and yet because they have to talk about the other actors, the actor filmographies, you get mentions of things you would never mention. And like, what other comic book is going to mention Federico Fellini? You know, like, right. I mean, what child's even going to know who that is, you know? But yet they have to put it in. You're like, oh, okay, I don't know. Does he do Marvel Fumetti comics? I have no idea. I don't know who that is. You know, like, who is that?
Well, so. Last time we got Last Tango in Paris.
Yeah, right, exactly, yeah. You're going to mention the X-rated movie here. Like, okay.
Hey, kids, you'll never look at butter the same way again.
Oh.
Mommy, can we watch that movie with Jor-El? Which one is it? Last Tango? Oh, my God. What is this?
Followed up by Deliverance with Ned Beatty.
Right, yeah, exactly. You know, like, jeez. Oh, my goodness.
Sorry you mentioned Deliverance. I saw that when I was 12 with my mom.
Gosh.
Okay. And my mom's passed, so I can tell this story. We get to the end of that scene, right? And And I'm 12 and horrified. And my mom, just out of nowhere, oh, he'd be in shock. That really hurts.
What? Ooh.
Oh. I'm just like, Mom, I can't process this. Why are you hitting me with that?
Oh, God.
What the hell is wrong with you?
Oh, man.
Well, you can cut that out, Rob. That's
Moving on.
let me one more thing on Terrence Stamp. Does he not look like an art critic right here or something?
Oh, definitely.
This is the guy that wants to take you up to his place to see his etchings.
Right, definitely.
And look at that stare, man. It would work. He's a very handsome, very handsome man. Next up is Jack O'Halloran, and I don't know who Jack O'Halloran upset or pissed off, but whoever chose the cutout still for his face really did not do him any. I don't know.
This album cover to his comedy album.
Yeah, I mean, ooh, that is a. I mean, you know, I mean, Jack's a pretty brutish looking guy. He always played. Yeah. You know, mooks and boxers and guys like, I mean, you know, he's in a great movie with Robert Mitchum called Farewell, My Lovely, which they even talk about here. But man, that photo of him is not complimentary. I mean, oh boy.
Let me ask you guys a question. When you were kids, did you get Jack O'Halloran and Richard Kiel mixed up?
Oh, all the time.
Okay. Okay. Because he looks like Jaws in this picture.
Absolutely.
He looks like, you know, David Prowse and Jaws had a kid. And this is the result of that.
He's got a little bit of Ted Cassidy in there, too.
Yep, I can see that.
Yep, yeah. No, yeah, it's, you know, hey, Hollywood needed those guys, you know. You're always going to work, you know. You're always going to have a job. So, contrasting the unflattering photo of Jack O'Halloran, we now have two pages of Sarah Douglas, which, okay, I don't want to exaggerate. They're not Playboy level photos, but they're just under Playboy level photos.
Yeah, this is FHM or like something like that. Now it's obvious she's got pantyhose on in that first picture because if you look at her feet, it's obvious. So
right. Yeah,
but that's not what the photographer is going for.
No.
She has on no pants.
Yeah,
in a sweater, a low neck sweater. Yeah. Get back, Loretta. she very much does. Yeah,
right. And then you have this other page of her doing a total Sybil Danning thing, where she's in kind of like this black jumpsuit with the zipper all the way down to her crotch, practically. And I don't know. I'm kind of amazed that they thought this was appropriate to put in a kid's collector's album for Superman 2. I'm just like, wow.
Somebody in production liked Sarah Douglas.
Oh, yeah.
And that's all I'm going to say about that. Now, these maybe have been just her publicity photos from the time.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, that's a lot of boob for a DC book. This is like, you know, this is like getting into like a Marvel black and white thing from the 70s.
Yeah.
I mean, this is like the most I had ever seen up to this point of the female figure, you know, I think. And this was before I caught Swamp Thing on HBO at my grandparents' house. You know, oh, hey, it's Swamp Thing. I know that from the comics, you know. Oh,
could you imagine if they had done a collector's album for that movie?
Somehow it was the international cut. I don't know how it was on HBO, but it was. So, but you got to think, you know, how many interviews have you seen with Sarah Douglas where she's like, I was the only one that would go out and do publicity for the movie. So, I mean, I guess she got the full court press with the publicity here as well, you know.
And really, do you blame her? Because they, you know, I'm sure you guys are going to cover this in the show, but, you know, June 19th, 1981, not only being the day my wife was born, but it was the day Superman 2 was released in the theaters in the United States, but it had been out in like other parts of the world for a full year before that.
Right.
So she got to travel the entire planet basically promoting this film. And I'm like, if you're going to pay my plane ride and I get to just sit there and talk to people, hell yeah, I'll do that.
Yeah. You know,
I mean, I love Richard Donner, but I like free stuff better. I mean,
I mean, I guess she figured as an actress that her angle was sex appeal. I guess, when she figured. And so she was going to highlight that. I mean, and I guess in contrast to Margot Kidder, who was kind of like the cutesy, sweet, innocent, although she does bed down Superman in this movie. But I mean, we'll get to the photo of Margot Kidder very after, and it's very sweet and wholesome. So I guess Sarah Douglas just saw that opportunity to say, hey, I could be the really sexy one, and I'll go from there. I mean, good Lord, they talk about, there's quotes from her, and she talks about being in the flying rig, and she's like, the experience was like nothing else in the world. While you're up there, it's absolutely exhilarating, but landing safely is tricky. I kept wanting to say things like, this is Sarah Douglas the Tower, Sarah Douglas the Tower, am I cleared for landing? Should I lower my flaps? I mean, of all the quotes for them to put in this thing, that's the quote they put in. So she was clearly angling for the sex pot part, and it worked for her. She was in other movies where she did that. So, you know, but yeah, it doesn't make you raise your eyebrow a little bit for a book aimed at children.
Silver boots.
Yeah. Then we have a nice, beautiful shot of Margot Kidder, which is clearly from the 1978 movie. It's not from Superman 2. Yeah. But she talks about how beautiful it was, so it's nice. It's beautiful, beautiful Margot. And it talks about her other credits, Superman 2, and her the Amityville Horror, Willie and Phil, and things like that. And then there's a Superman 2 mini portfolio, and it's just, again, more stills. Another shot of Superman looking really pissed.
Yes.
Really, really pissed, which is great. You don't want Christopher Reeve to get mad at you. And then another two more trading card kind of shots, one a nice little profile of him and another one of him flying the flag. And then you got the inside back cover, and it's more of the reverse, the checkerboard things with panels from the comic and shots from the movie. This is more character-centric things. And then the back cover is just a nice shot of Superman and Lois in the Fortress of Solitude, and that's our collector's album.
You know, I looking at all these pictures of Christopher Reeve as Superman in this album, you know, a lot of these were used for promotional purposes as well. And I again, it's an argument that I refuse to ever engage in again. But, you know, one of the things that they always said that people were complaining about when Man of Steel came out back in 2013 is like, he never smiles. And every time I see an image of Christopher Reeve, just a still image, he's not smiling either. So I don't know, like, of all the things to complain about that movie, he's not smiling is what they get hung up on. But when you look through this whole thing, it's just, you know, yeah, when he's Clark or when he's got the kid and he's landing, you know, but otherwise, you know, Superman was always presented. And I think the reason they did that back then was this is to prove that it's a serious film.
Mm-hmm.
So all of our promotional thing is just going to be Superman staring, you know, kind of taciturn. I have no proof of that, obviously, but still.
Right. Yeah. Go ahead.
This is a Superman that kills people. We'll get to it later on. But.
according to which cut you watch. Mm. But yeah. So.
That is a really bad redialoguing of that shot on the back cover, inside back cover. You can forget about ever dating me again, Mr. Kent. That's final. That's not what she's saying in that panel, because that's from Action Comics number one.
Oh, wow. Okay, cool.
Yeah, that is. Yeah. Yeah. Hmm.
It's interesting that the artwork that they're pulling from in here is so old. Like, you know what I mean? No Neil Adams, not even any Kurt Swan, as far as I can see. It's like Wayne Boring and Joe Schuster. Kurt Swan, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say Lex punching. Yeah,
right.
That's earlier 60s Kurt Swan. But yeah, no recent, like very few recent 70s, 80s shots. The shot of Lois and Superman kissing on the inside front cover is probably the most recent shot that you see, because it's obviously a 70s Superman and Lois. But the rest of them are all from the 30s through the 60s, pretty much.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. But I mean, overall, I mean, I mourn the fact that we never got an official adaptation. But that said, if you're going to put together a collector's album, I would argue this is a pretty good thing. I wish it had a few more behind the scenes stuff. Like, but that's just something I was interested in as a kid, and certainly today, of just more stuff of them actually making the movie. But I also realize that they're aiming this at children, except for the Sarah Douglas parts, and they don't want to maybe ruin the illusion that this is, you know, real to some extent. So they probably don't want too many shots of camera rigs and people with boom mics and stuff like that.
Well, they had that stuff in the first one, so I'm wondering if the troubled production didn't kind of steer them into kind of staying away from that for the most part, you know. It just makes me wonder.
Could be.
And if you look at, like, the first Superman, the movie Treasury, and then this, and then move into, like, the Starlog poster books that Superman 3 and Superman 4 had, it's like kind of a natural progression of how you promote this type of film. Because the poster books had a lot of behind the scenes and interviews and such, and outside of the, you know, posters you tore out of it. So,
right.
I think this does its job. I don't think it's as fun or as good as the Superman the movie one, but that's not to say that it's bad.
Right.
Yeah. I think it kind of feels like those $10 magazines you see at Walmart now when a movie comes out.
Yeah.
It feels like that. It feels like the same animal. And like Mike said, they kind of evolved into the Starlog things. And in fact, the shirt rip in the junkyard poster from Superman 3, the one from my childhood copy still hanging on Andrew's wall in his room. So it survived all these years.
I'm glad you mentioned those magazines that they put out now, because I see them at Target and stuff, and I have to admit, like, I'm such a size queen that I would only buy them if they were a Treasury. Like, if they were Treasury size, I would pick them up, but because they're magazines, I just blow right by them and I don't give them any money.
They are not worth the money. They put one out for, like, Superman's 80th birthday, and I'm sure Batman will get, like, 15. But and I leaf through it, and it's a handsome production. I mean, it's, you know, because and if I was 12, I would want it. But I think getting older and getting more crotchety, I'm just like, I've seen this before. I don't need it. So,
right. Yeah. It's like
up on the shelf.
Is this going to tell me anything I don't know? No. Yeah. You know, that type thing. Yeah.
Well, that's what I'm saying, is that I would buy it if it was big for no good reason other than it's just a treasury. I'd be like, I have to buy this, but because it's a magazine, I'm going to pass it up. So that's the Superman Superman 2 Treasury would be the last collector's album DC would do, because they would adapt Superman 3 and Superman 4 at this point after that. So this was it for – and this is, I think, to my memory, the last time they ever did anything like this, like a collector's album. They didn't do this for Batman, because after pretty much as of Superman 3, they could just do adaptations of the movie.
Right.
At that point, you know, to get Jerry Ordway to do the Batman movie adaptation or whatever. So this was it for this sort of particular unique form of commemorating a movie. So I guess that is going to do it for the Superman 2 Collector's Album. So Mike, Chris, thank you so much for joining me.
It was a real pleasure.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right. So Mike, where can people find you on the internets?
FortressOfBailey2.com. You can hear shows like From Crisis to Crisis, Overlooked, Dark Knight, which I'm putting out a bunch of episodes trying to get caught up recently. There's, like I keep saying, there's like 600, 700 episodes of various shows that you have to choose from. You'll find something you like eventually.
What a tagline. Well, Chris, of course, you and I are here to plug Superman 2 Movie Minute, which starts on the Fire and Water Podcast Network on Monday, May 6th. But what else do you have on the network?
The show that I do the most often besides Superman Movie Minute is JLU Cast with my wife, Cindy. That's where we cover the Justice League and Justice League Unlimited animated series, which features Superman. And since we're in season one, it's a severely down-powered Superman. But we're getting to the end of season one, and he comes back full heat vision blazing in Superman 2. So I'm really looking forward to that. So.
Electricity is bad. We all know that.
Electricity is evil. Yeah.
Evil. That's right. Evil. You're not bad. Evil. So, all right, everybody. Well, thank you so much for listening. I want you to stay tuned. We're going to play some podcast promos. And when I come back, I'm going to do some listener feedback.
Hey, Mike.
Shaq, what are you doing in my house?
I had a key made, but that's not important. Anyway, I just had a great idea for a trailer for that cute little network you do.
The Fortress of Bailey Tude Podcasting Network?
Yeah, that's the one. It's adorable. I love it. I mean, look at you, like with the network and stuff.
Thanks, I think.
Anyway, you know how people sometimes advertise something by, like, being extreme and suggesting that you just might die if you don't buy, like, a particular product or something?
Yeah, I believe those people are called sadists.
Sadists, that's one way you could say it, or guy with a marketing degree, kind of the same thing. Anyway, we could record a promo where I ask you something like, Mike, do you know who didn't listen to the Fortress of Bailey 2 podcasting network?
Who?
Gwen Stacy.
Really?
You know who else didn't listen to it?
Who?
Thomas and Martha Wayne.
The Waynes.
And Uncle Ben, not the Rice.
Uncle Ben.
And the entire planet of Krypton, except those that survived.
What about Bucky or Jason Todd?
Ooh, that's genius. Okay, we'll say they didn't listen, and then Superboy Prime punched a wall, and then they listened, and they were brought back to life.
I guess we could also say that Aunt May subscribes and unsubscribes all the time.
I love it. I love it. Now you're catching on.
I'm not doing that, Shag. I'm not going to suggest that people will die if they don't listen to the Fortress of Baileytude podcasting network, which hosts such shows as From Crisis to Crisis, Overlook Dark Knight, Views from the Long Box. It all comes back to Superman and Bailey's Batman podcast, and that they can find the network at www.fortressofbaileytude.com.
Are you sure? I mean, I do have like a marketing degree and stuff. I'm pretty smart.
No.
Can I at least be in the trailer?
Yes.
The Fortress of Baileytude Podcasting Network. The repository of podcasts produced and hosted or co-hosted by Michael Bailey. Head on over to www.fortressofbaileytude.com to download the shows directly. You can also find a master feed of all shows by searching for Fortress of Baileytude Podcasting Network on iTunes or your favorite podcatcher, or you can subscribe to the shows individually. The Fortress of Baileytude Podcasting Network does not suggest that not listening to any of these shows will prove fatal, nor does it endorse surreptitiously making a key to a friend's house for the purposes of busting in and suggesting ideas for podcast trailers. Music in this trailer by Kevin MacLeod.
So long. I won't let you down again.
It's finally here, coming to the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
General, would you care to step outside?
It's Superman 2 Movie Minute.
Chris Franklin and Rob Kelly are back to discuss 1980's Superman 2, 5 minutes at a time.
Superman faces his toughest challenge when he squares off against Lex Luthor and three villains from the planet Krypton.
Superman 2 Movie Minute, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Man, this is going to be good.
Tonight's special presentation of Superman is brought to you by Atari, a family of electronic products that challenge you, teach you, touch your life. Discover Atari and discover how far you can go.
And we're back with listener feedback for episode 34 of Treasury Cast, which was Shazam with Michael Lane. And we're going to go right to the comments from Fire and Water Podcast Network. First up is our fellow network all-star Ryan Daly, who says, this was a really fun episode to listen to. Michael is a great guest for the golden age knowledge. True that, Ryan. That's why I had him on. Edo Boznar says, yep, this was a very informative episode. I really enjoyed the discussion of these stories. By the way, Rob, I have to second Michael's recommendation for the Digital Comics Museum. It's a fantastic site full of all kinds of Golden Age goodness and a well I've returned to many times. Duly noted, Edo. Thank you. Chuck Coletta from the recently held BGS Batman Conference. Congratulations, Chuck. By the way, if you're hearing a jingling sound in the background, that is my cat Frankie playing with her jingle ball. She cares not for my recording schedule. He says, great episode, guys. I liked Jeff Johns' Shazam miniseries from a few years back. It made Billy seem like a real modern teen and not an Andy Hardy innocent. I especially love that John emphasizes the Marvel family aspect of the Golden Age stories and updates the Lieutenant Marvels in a contemporary way. Yeah, I didn't know – I hadn't read the Jeff Johns reboot of Shazam, and I didn't realize that the movie was taken pretty directly from that. So when I saw the movie, I was like, wait a minute, since when is Captain Marvel like a 12-year-old in an adult's body? That was never the thing. And then I realized that that's the Jeff Johns reboot. So good to know. He does mention he'd like to see a film. He'd like to hear Film and Water cover the new movie. I don't think I'm going to be getting to that because Film and Water is on hiatus, but it'll be back soon enough. So thank you, Chuck. Chris Franklin, of course, who you just heard on this episode, says, great episode. I too enjoyed all the Marvel family knowledge Michael dropped in this one. I don't own this Treasury, but I do have the one with Jackson Bostwick looking awesome on the cover. Yeah, I have that one too. That's probably my, like, I think, I don't know if I'd say it's my favorite, but it's the one I think of the most just because that photo cover is so iconic. He says, I've always liked Mary Marvel, but that fondness tripled when I discovered an old Mary Marvel watch at my grandparents that must have belonged to my late mother. I knew my mom was a comics fan, but this piece clinched it. So Mary has a special place in my geek heart. Love the Filmation cartoon Stinger at the end. That was a great series and was very faithful to the original comics in just about every conceivable way. Yeah, that's a great story, Chris. I knew that like there was a lot of Captain Marvel merchandise. I have a book. I think it's a Chip Kidd book where he talks about all the Marvel family merchandise. And so yeah, Mary Marvel and all the Marvels were like pretty big in merchandising, and so that's really cool that there was a watch. I'd have to dig that book up and see if that watch is maybe even in the book, but that's a great story. That's so sweet that your mom had a Mary Marvel watch. That's fantastic. And Michael Lane comments about that very thing. He says, I know the Mary Marvel watch you're referring to, Chris. I actually own the Captain Marvel one that came out around the same time. Stumbled on it in an antique store about 10 years ago. That's wonderful that they held on to your mother's and were able to pass it on to you. I associate the Marvels with family because they were my father's favorite heroes when he was a kid, so I am very touched by your post. Yeah, that's beautiful. That's a really great thing. Nathan Archer says, great episode as always, Rob. Michael was a great, extremely knowledgeable guest. There was a ton of trivia I really appreciated. I'm a lifelong fan of the Big Red Cheese, and I really like what Geoff Johns added to the mythology with the new 52 version. It does update the lieutenants by celebrating what the Marvels are about while getting rid of the more problematic aspects. So then Martin Gray from the Too Dangerous for a Girl blog chimes in responding to Nathan and says, I'm intrigued, Nathan. What were the Marvel family's problematic aspects? And then Nathan came back with, I'm glad big kids today can see themselves as Pedro rather than Fat Marvel. I also really like the injection of diversity, especially in a foster home setting. It just makes sense to me that there'd be a bunch of different types of people there. The whole concept of Shazam is just so awesome, and I'm hopeful more kids will see themselves reflected in the characters. I'm all for showing fidelity to the original comics, but you can't have a character called Fat Marvel nowadays. It's just not going to work. So, yeah, I'm glad that they made that change. Martin Gray came back again, specifically to the just talk about the episode, where he says, terrific episode. This was the first treasure I ever had, and I still treasure it. Aha. In the manner of all the best comics, it taught me a word, diorama. Mind, even as a kid, I wasn't going to wreck my lovely comic. I loved Kurt Schaffenberger's art from the first time I saw it. His rounded lines, lush finishes, gorgeous figure work, sublime storytelling, and mastery of emotion just chimed with me. Please find a show on which to discuss this DC great. That's a good idea, Martin. I would love to do kind of more art-specific shows. It's a little hard because obviously podcasting is a audio medium, but, we have the gallery post we can always do. So, yeah, I would like to do more art-related shows just because that's really more my thing than any other aspect of comics. Mike Deans said, well done on a great episode. It was fantastic to hear from both of you your enthusiasm on the Captain Marvel Shazam character. He's always been my absolute favorite, but I've never been able to find the treasuries that featured the character, though I guess the internet makes that a lot easier now. I thank Mr. Lane for bringing all the great Golden Age Marvel knowledge. It was great to hear. Some of the Golden Age stories, though kid-oriented, weren't afraid to go weird and have the confidence the kids would keep up. Any of the podcasts in the network that focus on Shazam certainly helped me find my joy. Keep up the great work. Thank you very much, Mike. Ward Hill Terry says, nice. Michael was entertainingly informative. I quite like his Twitter feed on comics in the Golden Age. I really appreciate all the background you both brought to us about this book. I never have read any of the stories included in this treasury, though I've read Shazam from the 40s to the 70s and other Marvel family reprints. Thank you, Ward. Sean M. Myers, my buddy, says, another great episode featuring a character I love with a fantastic guest who added so much wonderful information. One cool thing about Shazam and the treasuries is that he is the first superhero to have two, actually three, treasury appearances before any other hero is repeated. The only other double treasury appearance before Shazam were Rudolph and Tarzan. Yeah, that's really amazing that the Shazam got a bunch of treasuries long before Superman or Batman did. And I think we talked about that in a previous episode. I forget which one. But that obviously DC really wanted to make a splash
Flash with Shazam. It was a big purchase, and so they really wanted to give him the deluxe treatment, and so therefore he got a bunch of treasuries kind of way before Superman and Batman started piling them up. Gothos Mansion says, "The treasuries are the only Golden Age Captain Marvel stories I've gotten to read. I'm a huge Elvis Presley fan and knew about his fandom for Captain Marvel Jr. I really liked that this treasury spotlighted both Jr. and Mary so I could see the differences between their stories and the original Captain. I wonder if any readers back then were disappointed that the entire treasury wasn't devoted to Captain Marvel. Since you guys brought it up, I think the Papa Spank comment must have been a thing back then, because in addition to it appearing here and there in a Batman story, there was a Golden Age Wonder Woman story where she said Mama Spank. I don't remember what issue it was right at the top of my head, but it was in one of the Golden Age omnibuses. Omnibi? I don't remember if it was the issue where Wonder Woman spanked a female villain on panel. I wonder if I shouldn't have posted that. I don't want to get a rep as the pervy poster, but Mama Spank was pretty mild next to some of the stuff going on in Wonder Woman comics back then." True enough, and I almost... if memory serves, I almost think that that story, that the Mama Spank thing, was in the story that we covered way back in the Wonder Woman episode of Treasury Cast, where I did the three stories. I think that might have been in there too, so I'll have to go back and look. I'm certainly not going to do a Google search for Mama Spank, so thank you, Gothos. And then Diablo Frank chimes in and he says, "This was a positive show and I don't aim to muck it up. So let me just say my breast swelled listening to the incredible, bizarre imagination went into these truly fantastical tales. This is the Marvel family I want to read about." Yeah, they really were fantastical tales, Frank. That is absolutely true. They were all over the place, and that's one of the things I liked about them. So thanks everybody for the comments. I really do appreciate it. And now we're going to move on to Twitter. I want to thank everybody who retweeted the show. So big thanks to Ja Furry, Supermates Pod, Robert Magaha 55, Trowelfast, Dr. Ann 70, Firestone Fan, Once Upon a Geek, Oswald Liz, Maxo Romero, It's Plastic Man, CKL, Baramos Gonis, Valley Mike 07, BGUSA Batman Conference, Lair Du Art 2018, Tim Price 17, Barrowman for Ev, Squatala 16, Sasha Imamike, Justice Trek, Siskoid, Billy Delicious, The Kirby Cast, of course, that's Michael Lane, and Lightning 653. So thanks, everybody, for the comments. I really appreciate it. And thanks for all the retweets. Again, helps the show get noticed. And a big thanks to Michael Bailey and Chris Franklin for stopping by to talk about the Superman 2 Collector's Album, Treasury. And, of course, if you want to hear more of me and Chris Franklin talking about Superman 2, just wait 2 days for the network, and you'll see the first episode of Superman 2 Movie Minute. We're really excited to finally bring that show back. So thanks, everybody, for listening. And until the next episode, go big or go home.
A Superman film requires more draftsmen than it takes to plan a small town. The attention to detail is incredibly meticulous. The process of creating a widescreen epic requires a blend of many ideas. Once the writers, David and Leslie Newman, have written a scene in the script, it is then the job of director Lester to see how he can make it visual. Long before the camera turns over or indeed any sets are built, their joint visions are mapped out in literally hundreds of thousands of drawings. For instance, the art department made more drawings of the Eiffel Tower for a 4-minute scene than Alexander Gustav Eiffel did in 1886 when he built it.